Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 27th of January. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the Tea Party movement. They're going to be having a major convention in February of this year, although there are reports that there are fractures in the movement that threatens its future. And if history is any guide, movements tend to flame out. The Tea Party movement started on April 15, Tax Day, over criticism of President Obama's economic policies and what organizers call big government out of control. And we'll find out who makes up this group all over the country, the different factions within the group. I'm interested because you heard reports that Scott Brown's victory was in part due to Tea Party activists who came into the state who helped elect him. We'll talk about their influence. We'll talk about the convention. We'll talk about what guides their philosophy and the problems within the group. This first hour of our program today, it should be an interesting conversation. We have two guests with us. Professor Erica King is a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University and author of Framing the Iraq End War Game. Professor King, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. And Professor Elvin Lim is Assistant Professor of Government at Wesleyan University and author of The Anti-Intellectual Presidency, The Decline of Presidential Rhetoric from George Washington to George Bush. Professor Lim, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's on my mind right now because I never thought the news reports were flushed out on this. We heard reports that Tea Party activists came to Massachusetts to really campaign for Scott Brown and were instrumental in his victory. Can somebody tell me more about that? Did people come from all over the country with a guiding philosophy to help elect him?
Let me take a first shot at that. One of the things that we, I think, always have to be careful about when we're looking back at why somebody won or why somebody lost an election is that it's almost always a combination of factors and not one specific thing. But yes, there were people who represent some of the Tea Party movement who did actually go to Massachusetts and campaign. But I think it's a big leap of evidence to say that they were the force that brought this man to victory.
Mm-hmm. Professor Lim, do you agree?
I think that's right. I think he actually claimed that he was unfamiliar with the Tea Party, probably, I think it was about early January before he attended a fundraiser with the Tea Party people. I think, like all politicians, he's been rather opportunist about claiming victory when it was convenient for him.
Tell me, please, tell me about the philosophy of this movement. Is there an overarching philosophy? And if so, what is it?
One of the things that's very interesting as we witness something in its early stages is, sort of getting beyond the describing what's going on the ground to trying to make some sort of sense of what this is all about. And I think when it comes to the Tea Party, analysts, and I include myself in this, are still at the stage of trying to come to grips with exactly what is going on here. And from what I have been able to observe and study, I say that it's a loose kind of movement that's not unknown in American history. It's not like a political party, in my mind, with a very organized set of principles and agenda items, a checklist of what people stand for and what they want to achieve. I see it as a more loosely arranged groups of people who are very anti-establishment right now. We talk a lot about American voter anger at the moment, but I think with people who might be labeled Tea Partiers, it's sort of directed toward the Washington establishment, but it's not just anti-government. It's anti-big business. There's a lot of anger, for example, at Wall Street and Wall Street bonuses, the Detroit car companies. So I think it's anger at sort of us versus them, the big people who run America versus big organizations versus the quote-unquote regular people. And I see just sort of an expression of that, the frustration of people who feel that we as Americans are out of control of our own lives and our own destinies, and a sense of frustration.
And Professor Lim, you've written about the historical parallels here. It's not necessarily the American Revolution.
Yes, I think Professor King is exactly right that this is essentially a movement and it's not a political party. And movements tend to emerge during moments of economic crisis. This is a populist movement that has occurred several times in American history. And I think the closest parallel, the last one in which there was such a populist uprising, I think, was the Reagan Revolution, where there are very clearly ideological connections between the two. I think, to answer your previous question, it seems to me that the fundamental overarching idea behind the Tea Party movement is a libertarian rejection of taxation and high government spending and the establishment of a federal infrastructure and imposition of this infrastructure on ordinary Americans, and hence the title, the Tea Party Patriots, a referral to the events of 1773, in which Boston colonists objected to the tax that the British imposed on them. Of course, what's interesting was that the Boston colonists were rejecting a foreign metropole. Today's Tea Partiers are rejecting their own country. The officials in D.C., right? They said no taxation without representation. However, every member of the Tea Party movement has two senators and a couple of and at least one member of Congress from their state representing them. And so the historical parallel here should not be to 1773, but to, I think, the Jacksonian Revolution or the Reagan Revolution, in which citizens stood up against the power of the state, the federal government.
Was the tipping point here, Professor King, the bank bailout?
I think that was certainly a precipitating factor. I think there were other issues that were going on as well. I think the entire federal stimulus package was certainly a precipitator, and then Obama's health care reform proposals, also, I guess, the notion of big government. But as I say, what we have to remember is it's not just anti-big government agenda that's being expressed here. It's also anti-big business. And that's fascinating because I think as we try to figure out, and we're still in the process of figuring this out, what's the relationship between this movement and the Republican Party, that of course there's a whole big business wing of the Republican Party that is a target of this populist anger. And therefore, it's not just as though this is lockstep with the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. How do you answer that question, Professor Lane? What's the relationship between the movement and the Republican Party?
I think one thinks of the movement as a facet of the larger conservative movement, and the Republican Party is merely the political faction of these various movements congealed together to win governing coalitions. To that extent, I think one way to understand this movement is to see them as opposed to other factions within the conservative movement. There's the religious right, there are the neocons, who Irving Kristol reminded us were merely liberals that were mugged by reality. And because politics abhors a vacuum, what we saw with the Bush administration was the delegitimation of the neoconservatives. And so there was space within the conservative movement for other factions within it to arise.
Oh, that's interesting.
And hence we have both the Christian right emerging, and in particular, this liberal libertarian faction that has emerged because the neocons are after all, the neocons very much believed in government spending and expansion of the state in order to pursue these abstract liberal ideas about expanding democracy in the rest of the world. And I think this libertarian faction emerged to fill this gap.
And I very much agree that the whole issue of anger directed toward many of the Republican leaders, and George W. Bush as one of them, is a manifestation of this, that there certainly is a lot of dissatisfaction. And here is where I think Republican leaders need to be somewhat concerned, shall I say, about this movement, is that it's not just directed at Democrats.
Mm-hmm. What about this convention that's coming up in February? I'm reading news reports that there are great factions among various groups that are part of the Tea Party movement, that some of them have pulled out of the convention, saying that they're worried about people are making money on it. Is there a great deal of dissension among the ranks?
There certainly at this point seems to be, but I think it simply reflects what many of the people involved in the Tea Party would say about themselves, and so therefore would not necessarily be unhappy about this. But over and over again, when people are interviewed, members of who consider themselves members of the Tea Party movement, sort of the ground forces, will say, we are not an organized group. We do not have a specific leadership to whom we all answer. And so, therefore, I think it should not be at all surprising that there is not unity, because that's not the necessarily totally the purpose of this group. You know, again, does this sow the seeds of their own destruction because there isn't this desire to be an organized group? That, I think, is an interesting empirical question.
Are there people out to make a buck on this, Professor Lim?
Oh, absolutely. Sarah Palin just received $100,000 for that speech
that
she's promised to give. And I think Tea Party Nation is charging something like $500, $550 for attendance. So actually, I think that's one of the sources of dissension within the movement, that this has turned from a grassroots movement into a money-making machine. And some elements within it are not happy about that. And I also agree with Professor King about the idea that this is a movement that was never meant to be a machine, a political machine, and therein lies the seeds of its both success and its failures, because we have a very, very strong, dominant two-party system. It's very hard to break out this duopoly. And what movements have to do if they want to become viable is to be able to create what political scientists and Mensah Olson call selective incentives to their members, and to exclude these select incentives to outsiders of the organization. The problem with a grassroots movement is it's very easy for free riders to come in and out of this movement. And that is why this movement, if it's to become a machine, must find some way to give benefits only to its members and not to those outside.
Is Sarah Palin the leader of this movement, Professor King?
I would say absolutely not. And I think that she would be the first to agree with this also. She certainly is an extremely well-known face of one facet of the Republican Party. But even when you talk about Sarah Palin, you talk about a lot of Republican anger being directed toward her. It's not just coming from the left. So I think she is somebody whom a lot of individuals in the media may use as the face of the party, because it's so much easier to do that than to try to make sense of a very incoherent, disorganized kind of grouping. And it's much easier to point to one individual and say, this divisive, polarizing figure is obviously what this movement is all about. I just think that's not correct.
Mm-hmm. Then why is she the keynote speaker?
I think to make somebody a keynote speaker has a lot of public relations aspects to it. What you would like to do is, if I were doing some sort of organization, even if it's not well-defined, what you want to do is get publicity for your movement, to bring in people, comment as we are, commenting on it, discussing it, talking about it. And what better way than to bring in an extremely high visibility individual?
Mm-hmm. Professor Lim, what's the political clout of this group?
I think its power rests in its negative power and its ability to wrest votes away from the Republican Party, as it occurred in New York this 23 in a special election. And that's why Republicans are both trying to tap into the energy while also simultaneously being very wary about what this energy could do. It's power that you may not be able to control. And I think it's in this negative power that we'd see its political clout, this movement's political clout.
Let's look at, I can't remember the guy's name, it's Charlie Crist and his opponent in the Florida Senate.
Rubio.
Yeah, thank you. That race now has it going toward his opponent, Chris's opponent. Is that due to dissatisfaction on the part of the people that we're talking about and some kind of organizational effort to move the Republicans to a more libertarian philosophy?
My answer to this question also rests with the nature of the American nomination systems, our political primaries in this country. But it also, I think, extends beyond looking at the Tea Party movement. And even if, so if we can, for a second, just sort of discount the Tea Party movement, what I would say that is when we look at political primaries, the nominating process by which a party decides on who its nominee will be for a particular office, what you tend to see is the people who are more conservative on the Republican side being the base of voters for the Republican primaries, and then the mirror image of that on the Democratic side, where you get more liberal, committed, ideological voters who participate in the primaries there. So I see that, yes, the Tea Party is part of the problem that Governor Crist is facing as he tries to become a senator. But I think it's also the fact that he has been trying to hew to a moderate path, and that conservatives in general, beyond the Tea Partiers, are not best pleased with him as the representation of what they would like to see their Republican candidate be.
Mm-hmm. We are going to welcome phone calls for both of you. We're getting background information on what the Tea Party movement is in this country, how politically successful they are, their convention that's coming up, the dissension among the ranks of people who consider themselves part of the Tea Party movement, who all is in that movement, and welcoming phone calls. Our guests are Dr. Professor Elvin Lim, Assistant Professor of Government at Wesleyan University and author of The Anti-Intellectual Presidency, The Decline of Presidential Rhetoric from George Washington to George Bush. And Professor Erica King is a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University, author of Framing the Iraq War Endgame. Here's our phone number. Here's how you get a hold of us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The president, of course, giving his State of the Union address tonight, and we will be talking about it during this time period tomorrow. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Lim and Professor King, starting with Scott from Green Bay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I just have a question. I know this Tea Party movement seems to actually, I don't know if the word is progressed or but moved on into but from its inception, it really kind of started out as a protest movement more than anything else, and now it seemed to turn into something else. And even at the beginning of it, it was portrayed pretty much in a negative light because they would kind of focus in on a few of the real nut jobs, I guess, to say that were there. And I'm wondering if we could relate it all to the protest movement at Camp Casey when there was a huge protest down at Crawford. When that was on the news almost nightly in a very positive light. And I'm wondering if your guest could comment on why. And I know that, like I said, the movement has moved on for the Tea Parties, but really at the beginning it was always a negative connotation of these people. But Camp Casey was such a uplifting, positive thing that we had to portray it in a positive light every night on the news.
Professor Lim, you want to start?
I'm wondering if, you know, it depends on whether or not these protests are on the left or on the right. And I think that the media, rightly or not, took on a rather harsh stance towards the Tea Party movement in part because it began to be allied with the birtherist movement at the same time. And one of the major commentators for the Tea Party movement was, in fact, Glenn Beck, who wasn't very popular amongst the more liberal media. And I'm wondering if it may just be the framing and the connection of this movement with the birthers that caused the coverage to be less than positive.
I think one of the things, if I might also interject a note about our contemporary media, and that is that what we are witnessing is the increased fragmentation of American media. And the fact that if you look at certain of our media outlets, I would say, yes, indeed, the protest movement that is the Tea Party did get quite a bit of negative coverage. But if you look at another very important part of our contemporary media scene, and that would be Fox News, it has been portrayed on that network in a much more positive fashion. And as we know, even though as of yet Fox News has not always reached the audience that the broadcast networks have, its audience is the one that is growing in contemporary America. So there are different versions of what this protest movement represents that I think are reaching different segments of the American public, because what we also know with contemporary media is that when Americans have the opportunity to listen to different frames, different perspectives on different media outlets, what they're starting to do now is to increasingly choose those media outlets that reflect, not surprisingly, their own point of view, so that the individuals in this country, and there are many, who watch Fox News or who listen to many of the very popular, more conservative talk radio programs, are getting a very positive view of the Tea Party movement.
Sure. Here's an email that's coming in. My question is, how have these people been suckered into believing in policies that for the last 30 years have been making the wealthy even wealthier while destroying the middle class? They are shooting themselves in the foot. Professor Lim?
I think this is rightly a populist movement that represents a lot of the anger against the connection between Washington D.C. and Wall Street, and it seems to me that what's interesting about this question is the extent to which it reflects this very, very huge popular discontent at what's going on out there. And I'm wondering if the Tea Party movement may outlast this economic recession. And I think probably not.
Do you think that's true, Professor King?
You know, one of the things that I have learned as a social scientist is that we social scientists tend to be very good at analyzing what has already occurred and not very good at predicting what's going to happen. So I'll be honest and say that I don't know. But what I can do is looking to history. What we do see is the rise and fall of these movements that represent quite a bit of public anger and discontent about political change, social change, and economic problems. And there is a history of them rising, but then also at least almost all of them that I can think of have in fact played themselves out.
They tend to be co-opted by the major political parties.
Hmm. Jean from Denmark, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment that I'd like scholars to comment on is, if this is such an unorganized movement, I guess they don't have to really take responsibility for any of the kind of nuttier or fringe things that we see at their events, such as, you know, depicting the president as a monkey or calling for lynch mobs or just Nazi rhetoric. So, it's pretty convenient to stay unorganized for them, it seems to me.
Thanks for your comment, Jean. Professor King?
I think that's a very interesting point. But I think that what happens nowadays is that political leaders and organizations and even a disorganized movement always have to worry about discounting the sort of the fringe, television-focused, more strange antics of people who claim to be their followers. So I think this is a phenomenon that almost everybody in politics today has to deal with. I don't think it is just this particular movement. But if you do say you are not a very organized kind of entity, I think it is easier to discount, yes, the fringe part of your own group.
Right. Mike from Green Bay, hi.
Hi, this is Mike. You may have answered some of these questions already. I apologize. I'm just curious as to its origination, if there's what kind of money is backing this movement, what's the demographic makeup of the movement, and what does that mean toward its longevity if it is, for example, solely white-based middle class? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Professor Lim, you want to start?
Oh, interesting. I think your caller is exactly right that there is a fairly predictable demographic to the Tea Party movement, and I note that they are very similar to the demographic that voted for Andrew Jackson in 1828, rather similar to the coalition that Reagan collected in 1980. These are essentially middle-class white folk who feel disenfranchised from a liberal progressive movement that has fought so hard to use the state's powers to solve the problems of minorities, to put things blankly. That said, I do want to say that I don't want to characterize this movement only as a fringe movement, though. This has always been a very legitimate tradition in American politics. These are, when it comes down to it, I think people who are a little bit more partial to the Declaration of Independence than to the Constitution. These are the Tea Partyists, the original Tea Partyists, were people who believed in freedom and liberty and a revolution against the establishment. And this is a very, very strong strand in American politics. And the reason why there's money coming in is precisely because it taps into something that's very real in American politics. And so I don't necessarily want to characterize this movement as fringe. Indeed, I want to argue that some of its major demographics are very much a dominant part of the American scene, political scene.
And Professor King, how large is this? Are we talking thousands, tens of thousands, millions?
At the moment, this is not that easy to measure because, again, it's not a specific organization for everybody. Yes. Now, what you can do is you can go on to internet sites, social media sites, and see who's linking with whom. But part of the power of a social movement, and as I say, I very much appreciate what Professor Lynn just said, and that is that this represents a lot of people in America who may not actually be signing up for something, if that makes sense. You know, that they're not sort of saying, I'm contributing X amount of money. But I think the power of a social movement is its ability to tap into prevalent sentiments, and sentiments that are very politically potent are sentiments of frustration and anger and the desire to change something and to focus in on who it is that are causing our problems. And I think the potential power of this movement is that there are a lot of people out there who are not necessarily, as I say, signing a petition or going on to some sort of social media platform and doing this. But I think that it does reflect despair for some people, anger for other people, and frustration for still others. And so I think that the potential of this is to have large numbers of people who feel a similar way. Now, the question, of course, that we're all interested in is, what does this translate then into specific political action?
Right.
And that's what we don't have the total answer to yet.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Phil from Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Hello, Phil. Go ahead.
I just have two questions. One is, what role, if any, does Dick Armey play in this? And the other is, if a Republican had been elected president, would this movement be going strong? And why didn't they say anything during the Bush years? There was absolutely no comment while Bush was spending all sorts of money and expanding the government.
Mm. Thank you, Phil. Who wants to start?
The caller does make some interesting points. As I say, there was quite a bit of aggravation toward Bush on the part of conservative, or at least fiscally conservative, Republicans, but it didn't translate into a movement. So I think what's interesting is all movements take some sort of series of precipitating events, and I think that the election of Obama was one of those events, and then the kinds of people who are conservatives see as the overextension of big government, that I think that was sort of the precipitating moment that brought this out. The role of Dick Armey relates to, I think, another part, interesting part of this, and that is there are organized, specific, smaller advocacy organizations that all are much more structured, that are not necessarily unified with this more incoherent Tea Party movement, but are certainly trying their darndest to ally with it, to tap into that much larger public sentiment. So there are these bodies out in space that are potentially linking up with each other, but not on all issues.
Professor Lim, what action could be taken by this administration to take the wind out of their sail?
I think in the State of the Union address today, Barack Obama is going to try to do exactly that, and that is to talk about jobs, and to offer contrition and humility about the hubris that federal governments can solve everything, and to attempt to put some limits on federal spending. I think he's going to try to do that, and we'll see if that works.
You agree with that, Professor King? Is there something
I think
more?
We're going to see him doing that, but these are potentially difficult political times for a president who has a more, I would say, to the left of center or liberal agenda, a progressive agenda, because when he does this, of course, what he risks doing is something that's already beginning to happen, and that is to alienate your progressive base, people who feel as though he's attempting to sell out to the other side. So with every conciliatory and sort of populist sentiment and policy that he expresses, there's going to be a dissatisfied part of the base. And one of the things that that I think we saw very clearly in the gubernatorial elections in 2009 and the special election we just had in 2010 is the failure to turn out the much of the liberal base of the party, and that's a real worry for Democrats for the midterm and the presidential forthcoming election.
It seems to me as though that was the base that he was wildly successful in turning out and thus secured the presidency for him.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you, Jim?
I'm fine.
Good.
What you don't see, I think, is that this is an awakening, and the recession doesn't really have that strong of a link to it. It's just one thing that brought it up. Obama got elected underneath a giant spotlight, and now he's under a microscope. And it's really caused people to dig and search for their own answers and information on the Internet, on talk radio, on both sides. And what you're seeing and why you can't put it in the group is because it's peppered everywhere. People are starting to really think about it. Obama brought this all to light, and now most people can make up their own mind. Well, do we want a bigger government, or do we want things to do? We want more control for ourselves. I think if you went to one of these tea parties and you mingled amongst the people, I think you'd get a better understanding of what it is. There's a lot of hardworking people, a lot of smart people. There's a big cross-section. There's even union people there. People are starting to figure out what a liberal agenda is, and they're becoming more aware of politics. It's a big awakening.
Would you consider yourself a member of the Tea Party, Jim?
No, I just don't have time. But a lot of the people that I associate with who have their own business and who are working hard, they don't really have time either, but they're finding time to make these meetings. And I will take my family and other friends' family out in the future. This is not purely recessional. This, just because we're mad we need something to do, we're not that simple. It's just we're listening to politics, we're watching it, and we're figuring this out by listening to different programs and getting our own information. We don't trust NBC anymore. It's a big awakening, and it's not going to ever really be a group. And Sarah Palin does definitely represent us because she's the most common person ever on a ballot.
Uh-huh. And what are your priorities? What is upsetting you? What do you want to have changed?
What do I want to have changed? I want taxes lowered so we can make our own decisions. The government can't really solve anything. They can just protect this country and do other small things. You know, everybody wants power. It really doesn't make a difference who it is. I would just rather have something that's private have the power, because you always have the power over their bank account. You can either go there or not go there. They're kind of slaves to you if you really want to look at it that way. Where the government just gets big and large, and they just do what they want, and it's so hard, even by election, to make a difference. At least with a private, you know, organization, you can just not choose to do business with them. And they're pretty beholden to the people. So I want government to go away. I want them to let us be and make our own decisions. I don't have problems with people making a lot of money. That's the fun of being in America. Make as much money as you can. Be free. Do what you want. I don't want policies that govern everybody else. Just everybody do something, get to work, make money. It's that simple.
Okay. Professor Lim, you want to respond?
Yeah, I think your caller taps into that very real tradition in American politics just spoke about. There's always been those, you know, if you look at the original, the first debate Americans ever had between themselves, what was it about? It was Federalists who believed that government could be used to do good, and the Anti-Federalists believed, just leave us alone. Right? Their belief was that a consolidated government, quote-unquote, was going to be a tyrannical institution that would take away our rights and our ability to act and as individuals. And so I think your caller rightly represents one side of this ancient quarrel Americans have always had between themselves, the power of a government to do good and the power of government that is itself to be feared. And I think this is always going to be a permanent dynamic in our political debate, and there's no real answer to it, because the truth is our founders encapsulated both of these conceptions in creating a constitution which gives government powers to do things for us, and then a Bill of Rights the 10 amendments tacked onto the Constitution that sets restrictions to what government can do.
Professor King.
I think that the caller represents beautifully and extremely articulately the main strands of thought within this particular movement. And I think if you listen carefully to what he's saying, what you recognize is that absolutely, as Professor Lynn was just saying, you can't just dismiss this at all as some sort of crazed fringe movement or people who aren't thinking, who are just being foolish. I think that it does represent this strong strand of American political thought, and I think this is why political leaders across the spectrum are thinking about this and wanting to pay attention to it. And one further thing also is that we talk as political scientists and also civic leaders about the importance of engaging the public in our political system, and we bemoan the decreasing voting rates in contemporary America. So I think that a movement that does get people involved and thinking, even if it's not necessarily the way one thinks oneself or one's own position on the issues, that we should applaud the notion of people wanting to think about what's going on in the political system and who are concerned enough to get together and talk about how to change things.
More phone calls in a moment. We're getting background on the Tea Party movement in this country with two guests, Professor Erica King, professor of political science at Grand Valley State University, author of Framing the Iraq War Endgame. Professor Elvin Lim is also here, assistant professor of government at Wesleyan University, author of The Anti-Intellectual Presidency, The Decline of Presidential Rhetoric from George Washington to George W. Bush. Our phone number, our lines have been busy, but just keep trying, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to send one of those messages, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight, President Obama gives his State of the Union address. We will carry it here on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow during our show at 9 o'clock, Mike Ushay joining us, distinguished fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University, host of Upfront with Mike Ushay on WISN. Also joining us, Professor Julia Azari, assistant professor of political science at Marquette. So I'm sure that everybody in this audience will be watching tonight, and we'll talk about all of it tomorrow. 800-486-8655 is our number. Let us go next to Jacob from Madison. Hi, Jacob.
Hi there. I guess the thing that disturbs me is the kind of every man for himself mentality of it. I don't think that we're at a time in history where it makes any sense to be swayed by corporations, but think we're all in it for ourselves and are going to get somewhere. We need government. We are all part of the government. We need to realize that and make it work for ourselves. Government helps us with the transportation system. There's so many good things about what government brings us. I don't think it makes any sense to divorce ourselves from the idea of government by the people, for the people, and of the people.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Professor Lim.
Well, I think that's precisely the point under debate, whether or not this government is off and by and for the people. I think the Tea Party movement people disagree. And, you know, that I think you have both callers now very articulately explained why is it that they believe that government is the source of good, and why is it conversely government is the source of a potential tyranny. I think that is exactly what the debate is.
Would you like to respond, Professor King?
I absolutely agree, and I think this is where both the benefits but also the pitfalls for each of our political parties lie, is that there are many individuals in the United States who many of whom call themselves independents, who are not strongly allied with either political party, and that whole issue of the vision that people hold of the role that government ought to play in a society becomes a very, very key issue, especially in times where there are real economic problems, but also in other times as well. But as I say, I think it becomes particularly acute in economic problems. So that basic fundamental question that our founding fathers argued through, Professor Lynn mentioned, I think that still 200 plus years later is something that this country has not resolved.
Mm-hmm. Professor Lynn, if this Tea Party movement wanted to become a strong force in America, why wouldn't they start running people for office, or maybe they are, try to get their philosophy a big part of the mainstream political philosophy in this country?
Well, first of all, an overarching theoretical answer to that, and that is there's something paradoxical about a movement that is anti-power,
yes,
seeking power.
Right.
And so they're stuck in a bit of a rut there. And that's why you see people like Glenn Beck really promoting candidates not so much to get power for power's sake, but to be able to dislodge members of the two major parties if and when they fail to address the sorts of issues that the Tea Party movement is committed to. So this is really an issue-based movement rather than an electorally-based movement. That is to say, they're less motivated by winning elections than by having issues placed on the public agenda.
And yet there are parts of maybe branches of this movement that are trying to get people elected to decision-making bodies or trying to get people involved in the process of selecting candidates, aren't there, Professor King?
Oh, yes, and this is, as we've been talking about all hour, it's got different elements to this party, and shouldn't say party, excuse me, to this movement. And part of it is that as an issue-based movement, what you are looking to see, but you're not just supporting one particular party or one particular candidate, but that what you're looking to do is carefully to peruse who the candidates are and to see what their stands are on the issues that you care about. And in some instances, that perhaps means running your own candidate. In others, it means vetting who the other candidates are and then deciding whom to support. But either way, it gives a great deal potentially of power to a movement like this.
We go next to Jack from Stoughton. Hi, Jack.
Good morning. I have a what-if question or two, and the first has to do most particularly with the Tea Party movement. What if the Tea Party movement is a representation of how the electorate sees that the government, unlike the founders intended, is no longer no longer serves the populace, but instead is paid for. It's an arm of the corporation that the founders wanted not to have the same voice as the citizenry. That's the first what if, and the second what if is. I'll let you chew on that one and stay on the line, and if I can figure out how to articulate it, if there's time, I'll try to get the other one out there too.
Professor Lim?
Wow. Well, the first what-if is a very big what-if, because the Declaration of Independence puts quite clearly, it is self-evident, that, quote, whenever, I think, any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new governments. This is Rick Perry, governor of Texas' position. You know, when he was essentially coming very close to committing to the idea that secession may well be the answer, and secession is but the state's response to an individual right to revolution against one's government if it's become taken over by corrupt interests. And that is a very interesting question because it poses to us which comes first. Is it the organic community of we the people as constituted in the United States, or do our individual rights, our Lockean rights, our rights to life, liberty, and property, or the pursuit of happiness, precede our organic identity as members of a polity? That, of course, is the fundamental question here. Mm.
Is Rick Perry a part of the Tea Party movement?
I think he's been asked to speak several times. And, you know, when he was talking about the secession statement that drew some attention from the media, he was...
Oh, yes, it did.
Yeah. He was speaking at one of these Tea Party events.
Right.
But on the other hand, Rick Perry is also an elected Republican official, and as somebody who then has to deal with a whole set of range of other kinds of issues, he also risks alienating if he makes a move on the issues that Tea Party members don't agree with. I think the scary thing for an elected official is that these individuals can just then, in fact, say, oh, we're not interested in that person anymore.
Yeah, I think back to the very first question we had, I think that's why a lot of the media, not just the liberal one, are very uneasy about this movement, because there are certain elements, not all the elements, but certain elements that stand against the grain so much that they would even conceive of the possibility that this constitution has gone corrupt and it needs to be overturned. And hence the revolutionary spirit of 76 has been used to name and title this movement.
Do you have, on the other hand, or what if part two, Jack?
Yeah, and I'll go to, well, how about that Obama represents the embodiment of this dissatisfaction and displeasure with so many years of you know, government being the best corporate money can buy, and we'll see what happens in the State of the Union address. But how about what happens if he really comes on like Give 'Em Hell Harry did, and takes the corporatocracy to task, so that what we see is maybe corporations have to contribute more the way we taxpayers do. Maybe we tax corporate profits or something like that. Part of my thesis, and I don't want to get into Democrat or Republican, but part of my thesis is this. It seems to me, in my lifetime, and I'm a boomer, it seems to me every time there's been a Republican administration in my lifetime, what happened was they spent the kitty. They spent the treasury dry. And the Democrats tend to replenish the treasury, so we have jobs and we have services and we have infrastructure. And if that's not just my cockeyed view of the world, if that's what really happens, here's another question, so I'll finish everything. Where's the middle ground? Where do we get a balanced government? And is that what the Tea Party movement is evidence of, that the populace is saying, okay, guys, both sides, enough. What we don't have is enough jobs. Jobs are easy to create, because all we do is say, what work do we need to have done?
All right, Jack, thanks for your call. Professor King?
Wow, that's a complicated multi-part essay question. I'll try the simple part of the essay question, which is Obama as the embodiment of some of the frustration that is being evidenced. As I say, that's the easy part of the question. And I think this is a problem for him, because in the mind of so many of the people in the Tea Party movement, the fussing is anti-establishment. So, of course, the President of the United States is the representation of the establishment, but it's also anti-big government, and a president who does have a progressive agenda is not going to be one who is going to be easily won over to the hearts of the Tea Partiers. I really don't think that Obama coming out with populist rhetoric about, yes, big government isn't the perfect thing, is going to satisfy people who more purely feel the anger about big government in general. They're still going to be saying, yes, he's just, you're putting icing on the cake, but the cake is still there.
And the thing that, as we've mentioned before, is so ironic about this is that he is labeled as a guy with a progressive agenda, and yet progressives are saying, what the heck, where is your progressive agenda? So he's kind of in a bind, huh?
He is very much in a bind, because, again, you're absolutely right. Progressives are increasingly seeing, whether it is national security policy or lack of what progressives would like to see as certainly a public health policy, they're seeing something not going the way they wish.
Right. Let's take at least one more phone call if we can. Donald from Evansville. Hi.
Hello. If you had lost your job, lost your insurance, your house was in foreclosure, and you've just watched the Democrats in power for the last year acting like Mo, Larry, and Curly, you would be extremely disgruntled with the government. And my only advice to Obama is that he shouldn't go back and try to go bowling again, to think that we're a bunch of saps and are going to believe that kind of phony PR. We want things done in this country. Thank you.
Professor Lim.
You know, I think Barack Obama has learned, perhaps painfully, that there's a distinction between campaigning and governing. And governing forces you to make decisions to not no longer equivocate between false choices, he would call it. And he has been forced to a place where governing in the middle has proved very, very difficult, either in terms of delivering to Wall Street and then as well as delivering to Main Street. And I think he's going to have to try very hard to find that middle ground and realize that he's never, ever going to have either side love him. He'll have to sometimes pick a side and sometimes alienate both sides when it comes to the economy and jobs.
Hmm. Well, this has been an interesting conversation. Thank you both so much for being with us. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Professor Erica King, professor of political science, Grand Valley State University, author of Framing the Iraq War Endgame, Professor Elvin Lim, assistant professor of government at Wesleyan and author of The Anti-Intellectual Presidency, The Decline of Presidential Rhetoric from George Washington to George Bush. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. A reminder that tonight we will be airing the State of the Union address, and we'll be talking about what the president said tomorrow during this time period from 9 to 10. Open line coming up, so call with marvelous suggestions for us, and news is ahead as well. This is the Ideas Network.